are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 13th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Julia Yaffe, writing the Atlantic magazine, What Putin Really Wants. Meanwhile, last night in Alabama, the thrilla in Alabama, Doug Jones wins, ladies and gentlemen, by what was 1.5 points?
I believe it was 1.5 points.
Meanwhile, Mitch McConnell refuses to cede him quickly. Also, just as a side note, apparently Denny Hastert had his probation tightened.
When you're committed to a craft.
There you go. Doug Jones, big win. Huge turnout by the African-American community in Alabama. This is a big story of a legitimately activated base and ground game. Meanwhile, Rod Rosenstein at the House Judiciary Committee as the intent to fire Robert Mueller intensifies. Republicans still seem to, or I should say, now have seemed to, in the past 20 minutes, we got word that they have forged a tax deal. They hope to be voting on this in the House and the Senate by Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. Maybe they may pull it up quicker. Also, our good friend Mike Cernovich and his buddy Chuck Johnson may be getting a visit soon from the Capitol Police.
Who?
Yes.
You mean Mike Cernovich?
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't pronounce it.
I was confused.
As they try to pass on fraudulent documents to smear Chuck Schumer.
Sometimes when you lose a smaller battle, you go to win a bigger battle, and then you really, really, really lose.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas says the very much expected U.S. no longer can function as an honest broker in Middle East peace. Rex Tillerson, apparently under the cover of somebody inside the White House, says the U.S. is ready to talk to North Korea. All that and more on today's program. It just incredibly exciting win last night, and it went down to the wire. At one point, it looked like Roy Moore was not going to concede. I don't know. He may not have conceded, but the Republican Party, I think he just did.
He just did. Okay. The last I saw this morning, he was going to ask for a recount.
The Republican Party in Alabama said, sorry, we're not interested in helping you with that endeavor.
I got a Jew lawyer. I'm going to fight this.
I mean, the problem he had, too, was that they weren't raising money for him in the first place. So I don't think that's going to happen. But Mitch McConnell, early in the day, must have realized there was a problem because he came out and said, we don't have plans to seat this new senator for a month, which is pretty stunning. Particularly when you go back and see what Mitch McConnell had said on Fox and Friends on January 20th, 2010, where he saw the election of Scott Brown in Massachusetts as a mandate to stop the Affordable Care Act. Now, of course, in the Senate, there were 59 once Brown won, Democrats. And the numbers are a little different, but apparently Mitch McConnell has changed his tune in that regard. But really important, because Mike Cernovich has been so kind in drawing attention to this program and to the work that we do here day in, day out. I wanted to return the favor by, and we'll talk a little bit later about apparently his involvement in this fraudulent and I would imagine an attempt to pass fraudulent documents with the intent to smear and false charges against a sitting senator is not going to be met terribly favorably by the authorities. But that's not what we're talking about here. Mike Cernovich had made a request of all of us back in November to screen capture his tweet where he said, Roy Moore is going to win the election unless he drops out. Screen cap this and you'll see that I'm right. We have, and maybe our screen cap technology is not working properly because it appears he was wrong. So, Mike.
Thufferin, thuckatash.
Yes, we're really sorry. And maybe better luck next time with that. Folks, you know, when we did get all that attention over the past couple of weeks, in the news a little bit, one of the side benefits was the amazing rush for people to buy my DVDs, my old film comedy DVDs. In fact, I had almost, well, no, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but it was between one order and one order for the Cedar Trilogy works over at Pilot Season DVDs. But it took me about 30 seconds to mail this thing. Why? Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips, or in this instance, mine. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package of three DVDs, any class of mail, the least expensive class, in my case, using your own computer and printer. Then the mailman picks it up. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale. Automatically calculates the exact postage. Print postage any day, anytime, any day. Stamps.com is always open. I use Stamps.com basically because it makes my life slightly less agitating. I just drop it in. I have like the whole system set up. I mean, I'm only shipping now three DVDs like once every 6 to 8 months.
I appreciate anything that helps you be less agitated.
Yes. But now I take the three DVDs, I stick it in the I got one of those like plasticky gray bags, and then, boom, I get my postage. Right now, you too can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Majority Report. That's Stamps.com, enter Majority Report. All right, so the big story coming out of Alabama is that the basically the black turnout. I mean, there was other stories. Doug Jones did better in the suburbs. Broadly speaking, Doug Jones outperformed, I think, Clinton in 2016. All that is to be expected on some level, particularly when you're talking about a federal race where there was, you know, nobody would have thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win Alabama. And so it was tough to get people motivated to vote. Part of this was there was a real sense in Alabama, hey, Doug Jones could win. And so I think you saw a lot of people who wouldn't otherwise have voted go out and vote. But the mobilization in the African-American community was huge. And apparently the DNC had 30 paid staffers there, sort of had done this under the radar. Also, the NAACP and other, there was a, I think it's Black Pack. I'm not sure exactly what it was called. Maybe it's that. Had poured in money as well. So there was a real concerted effort. But here is, of all people, Charles Barkley, sending a message to Democrats as to, you know, basically, well, let Charles Barkley say it.
I'm just so proud of my state. They rose up today.
Last question for you, Charles. What's your message for President Trump tonight? As an Alabamian, as somebody who helped deliver the state to Doug Jones, What do you want President Trump to take away from this evening?
Well, this is a wake-up call for Democrats. Your Democrats, and I told Mr. Jones this, and I love Doug, they've taken the black vote and the poor vote for granted for a long time. It's time for them to get off their ass and start making life better for black folks and people who are poor. They've always had our votes, and they have abused our votes, and this is a wake-up call. We got it in a great position now, but this is a wake-up call for Democrats to do better for black people and poor white people.
All right, Charles Barkley.
There you go.
Why is Charles Barkley an insanely better political analyst than 99.99% of people I see on Twitter? He literally just synthesized a unbelievably stupid and unnecessary argument that this Bernie and Hillary thing has been going on since 2016.
And he did it
off. He summarized it in 30 seconds.
He did it off of a question about what's the message to Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's perfect.
And he immediately says, look, the message to Donald Trump is Donald Trump. It's conceivable Donald Trump could become less popular, but the bottom line is this race was won because you saw a mobilization. And it's, you're not going to have every race where your choice is between somebody who thinks that America did black people a favor by basically kidnapping them and having them be slaves for a couple of centuries.
And by the way, the same way he gave favors to girls, little girls,
right,
that he tried to date. Yeah, you're not always going to have a candidate like that.
Now, with that said, of course, that was mitigated by the fact that he once hired Marshall, Black Eyes Marshall.
Who's clearly ungrateful. And also, may I just add, I mean, whatever, Sheriff Clark is an idiot, and it's probably useless to even bring this up. But, like, apparently, John Lewis, being one of the only people that came from outside of the state to campaign for Doug Jones, probably did play some role
in
that turnout. So maybe his iconic work in civil rights is, you know, sort of vaguely relevant to black people.
There was clearly a big mobilization here, but Charles Barkley nails it and says, you know, you've got to, a mobilization obviously is going to work in these circumstances, but broadly speaking, you have to give people a strong motivation to come out. In Alabama, there was a couple of things working. You had voters who were probably white, liberal voters in the suburbs who said, my vote's going to count this time for the first time. And for African Americans, they obviously, Roy Moore was someone you really don't want to be senator. And you've also have in Doug Jones, a guy who has shown that he was willing to go out and protect the civil rights of African Americans and go after people who, in Alabama, obviously has quite a history that in many ways they have pushed back on tonight. So, there has to be an active reason for voters to go out that is stronger than just preventing that guy, whoever that guy is. And generally, when we're talking about Republicans, it's that guy from winning. Meanwhile, also should say, I've got part of my holiday shopping already done. As you know, I travel to the Midwest to celebrate the holidays with the in-laws. And this time I sent my present out ahead of me. Yes. No matter who you're shopping for this season, Shari's Berries has the perfect gift for everyone on your list. You can't go wrong with this. Who doesn't like delicious strawberries dipped in various types of chocolate? My listeners can get fresh and delicious Shari Berries this holiday, dipped in white milk and dark chocolatey goodness, starting at $19.99 plus shipping and handling. Or check this out. When you double the berries for just $10, your gift will include a free keepsake dessert platter. That's two gifts in one. Shari's Berries has more than just berries. They've added new holiday treats like snowman brownie pops, cheesecake Christmas trees, artisanal chocolate truffles. Damn. Gifts arrived packaged in Shari's Berries signature gift box. No wrapping required. This is dangerous for me to read this stuff, because I just start picturing it. I ate about 8 of them last week. There's only one way to get this amazing $19.99 deal this holiday. Visit berries.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Enter my code CEDAR, S-E-D-E-R, at checkout. Remember, when you double the berries for just $10, your gift will include a free keepsake dessert platter. That's berries, berries.com, code CEDAR. And lastly, folks, Brooklyn and still warms my heart. They were the first ad we had on after we had our little situation. And the good news is Saul seems to be like, peed our bed in a long time. It's been like weeks. So my Brooklyn and sheets, they're staying a little bit longer on the bed, if you know what I'm saying. I'm not saying it would, I mean, we wash them, but I mean, you don't have to wash them every day now. Brooklinen cuts out unnecessary markups, retail licensing fees, and manufacturing waste in order to offer high-end designs and exceptional savings across their collection. This is luxury bedding, folks, underpriced. You have to try these sheets today. They're the winner of the best online bedding category by Good Housekeeping. Michael already knew that because he's got like a, you read all, constantly on Good Housekeeping.
Very avid Good Housekeeping reader.
I love my Brooklinen sheets. Try these sheets and I know you'll love them too. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer for just for my listeners. You get $20 off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident you're going to love their new sheets. They offer you a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. There's no reason not to give these sheets a try for yourself, or this is also a great holiday gift. Give the gift of luxury sheets. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping, use the promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, B-R-O-O-K-L-I-N-E-N. .com, promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Julia Offey, her piece in The Atlantic, What Putin Really Wants. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back, I think, if I'm not mistaken, to the program, Julia Offey. She is a staff writer at The Atlantic covering foreign policy and politics. Julia, welcome, I think, back to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you have this this cover piece in The Atlantic entitled What Putin Really Wants. And it really, it's a fascinating look into how what Russia did came about and what the context was. But let's start with what did Russia do in the context of our 2016 election?
So this is this stuff is pretty well established. We know that Russia hacked the servers of the Democratic National Committee and the DCCC, which is tasked with electing Democrats to Congress. And then it leaked that information through WikiLeaks, through various other outlets that were either set up directly by the Russian Secret Services or leaked to kind of willing participants. And they also created Twitter bots, Facebook ads, all aimed to kind of set things up to dissent and to amplify American political tensions and racial tensions, et cetera. They also scanned and probed the voting infrastructure and voter rolls in numerous states, about just under two dozen states. And it's still unclear, and it will always be unclear, I think. It's kind of impossible to gauge whether they swung the election or not. Personally, I think they were working on the margins, but it's still kind of unprecedented. Russia has never really done anything this active in our elections before. They've always, as one of my sources told me, have kind of nibbled around the edges of our elections, but they've never decided to go all in the way they did in 2016.
And I mean, the piece outlines the sort of there's a quality of like, holy crap, we can't believe that it worked out that way, a quality to their response. But before we get there, why did they at what level was this decision made to sort of upgrade their participation in our election, and what was the impetus for that?
So it seems like the decision came from the very, very top, that is Vladimir Putin. But I think what gets lost on Americans is, you know, we tend to think of, much like Russians do, Americans think that the rest of the world functions just like America. But the way that power is delegated and decisions get implemented in Russia is different. So what happens is Putin gives a signal and then... But it's generally a pretty vague signal. It's very important for him to have built-in plausible deniability, and there's a lot of stuff he doesn't know. And the other difference is that it's not all coordinated across various agencies and ministries in Russia the way it is in the U.S. So you have certain groups duplicating each other's work without even knowing it. So, for example, there were in the DNC servers, they found two Russian, you know, the footprints of two Russian government hackers. One was from the FSB, one was probably from the GRU, and the two hackers didn't know about the other Russian hackers. They were duplicating each other's work without realizing that the other one was there. This kind of competitive dog-eat-dog approach is not something we see, for example, in the American intelligence community. So it was very kind of ad hoc, and, you know, as one of my sources said, throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what would stick. But the command did come from the very top. And the impetus for it was in part to show that not only America can meddle in the internal political processes of other countries, that there was more than one regime change racket in town. And the other was to retaliate for the release of the Panama Papers. If you recall, the Panama Papers was a trove of documents from a Panamanian law firm, which is basically a tax haven where a lot of rich people, government figures from all over the world, stash their often ill-gotten gains. And Putin and his family and people close to him were very much implicated. They were very upset about that. And they think that the CIA did that, which they didn't. It was a bunch of independent journalists digging this up.
So, all right. So there's two things. I mean, first off, the idea of the way that Putin would order something like this really feels like an episode of The Sopranos where, you know, Tony sits back and just says, like, it would be really nice if that guy was gone. And two different captains
right.
say, like, oh, I'm going to get in good graces with this guy and I'm going to take care of it. I mean, is that sort of like...
Exactly.
Go ahead.
That's exactly right. So I think that people tend to think of the Americans when they think about Russia, the show, I mean.
Right.
But really, I think the best show that would help you understand how Russia works is The Sopranos. It is very much, you know, a lot of the people there come from that underworld. A lot of the people in charge have either come from that underworld or have intimate experience with it because of their experiences in the 90s in government and in business. And it is very much this kind of mafia-esque way of running things. About, you know, it's about family, it's about kind of dissipated control, it's about plausible deniability. But that's pretty much exactly how it works. And the problem with that is that once your capos decide to get in your good graces, you know, they have underlings who want to get in your good graces, and they have underlings who want to get in their good graces. And at some point, the system becomes kind of hard to maneuver and hard to stop once it starts rolling, because it's a giant, giant bureaucracy, pretty violent bureaucracy and corrupt bureaucracy, and it becomes very hard to control.
I mean, what accounts for that? I mean, I want to move on to because part of the other thing that's sort of fascinating is this notion that he would, you know, the reasons behind him wanting the plausible deniability and the idea that he would be embarrassed by the Panama Papers, it runs to sort of his relationship with the Russian people that I want to get to in a minute. But what accounts for my understanding of you know, sort of the idea of the mafia in Russia is that it's not compartmentalized in the way that it is in the United States, that it's more sort of like, at one point I maybe, you know, I move in and out of dealings that could be theoretically like organized crime-ish, but what accounts for the government working that way? Is it that there was never an establishment of institutions or of like a bureaucratic structure post the Soviet Union that would sort of keep people in their lanes, or what accounts for that?
So what actually ended up happening under Putin is that the state, the kind of the force, you know, the parts of the government that use force, the police, the secret services, the army, all these, you know, the investigative committee, which is kind of the analog of the FBI, moved into that space of organized crime and usurped what they do. So instead of, you know, Tony Soprano coming to your business and saying, you got such a nice business, it would be such a shame if anything happened to it, what you have is an FSB agent coming to you and saying that. And the way to, of course, get them off your back and not close your business and not get you arrested is to give them a cut. Or a cop comes and says that to you, or a tax inspector, or a or a fire inspector. And in part, this is because of what happened in the 90s, because the state fell apart. The Soviet state, which was totalitarian and oppressive, fell apart and became, what replaced it was extremely weak and very corrupt. And there was a lot of organized crime in the 90s. And part of what Putin did to reestablish control was to just have the state assume the functions of organized crime and to bring that into under the umbrella of the state, which is really troubling. But most Russians know that when something happens to you, don't call the police because they'll make it worse.
Interesting. Okay. And so and his plausible, I mean, you said he wanted to have some plausible deniability, and that is also consistent with the idea that he would feel embarrassed, or politically, it would be a political liability for what comes out in the Panama Papers. Because I think there's a sense in this country that, well, Putin's untouchable and he doesn't have to worry about, mm-hmm. why would he have to have plausible deniability and why would he be embarrassed by that? Because mm-hmm. nobody's going to do anything about it.
That's a great question. And I think it gets to the root of a lot of American misconceptions. Putin isn't Stalin. You know, he doesn't oversee a totalitarian state. It's a very weak state. And a lot of things are very personalized to him, which makes it even weaker in the long run. But he, you know, in the way that this, he is kind of a product of the late Soviet Empire, and he very much, there's that, but he also very much wants to be part of the West. I think he sees China, or any, like, China is a kind of less desirable partner. I think there's a lot of racism there. But he wants to be very much part of the West. And from what I heard, that he was even more upset that Russia was kicked out of the G8 in the wake of the Crimean invasion than he was by the sanctions. He very much wants to be at the table. To be at the table at the G8 with the big European powers, with Canada and the U.S., you have to be a democracy, right? You have to be, in some ways, a free market. You have to live up to certain Western ideals. So it's very important for him to show that he's doing these things. And so he has spent the nearly two decades of his rule creating very elaborate window dressings. And it's also very important for him at home to feel loved, in addition to feel that his rule isn't imposed on the people, but that it's that people like him, that it's legitimate, because in some ways that buys him more security, right? If your authoritarian rule is popular, you're less likely to be overthrown, or so you think. So he also likes to be right. So when people say you repress the free media, he says, what are you talking about? We have this radio station that criticizes me all day. Forget that he, you know, the Kremlin keeps a tight rap on the media and pressures advertisers not to advertise with them, to make sure that the opposition media is very, very marginalized, both economically and in terms of audience. When he says, look, we have elections, we have competitive elections, I have people running against me, all those people are on his payroll. And the elections are, you know, carefully engineered, not necessarily rigged. I mean, though they are rigged as well, but engineered so that the right result is delivered. But it's very important for him to say, look, I'm not a dictator. I'm not Muammar Gaddafi. I'm not Bashar al-Assad. I'm like you guys. I'm no worse than Angela Merkel. And I'm no worse than Barack Obama or Donald Trump. And I'm no worse than Theresa May. I too have elections. I too am accountable to my people. I'm not, you know, a Central Asian dictator.
And you write about, and this was fascinating to me, how, so he's got this sort of like, you know, almost like there's a quality, there's a little bit of like, there's a little Donald Trump in him, as you write about him, with this sort of, you know, sense that he's not being taken seriously in the same way as these other world leaders. And I imagine there's also sort of, there's also sort of that's part of the national psyche at this point to a certain extent too. But you also write about an intense, it seems to me, a fear. And you write about that specifically, about how the Russian role in Iraq started to form that sense, and ultimately what happened in Libya really got him, it seems to have made him very, very nervous in many respects.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a crazy fear, to be honest. You know, watching American foreign policy over the last 15 years, you know, the democracy promotion, policy of regime change, which, you know, still crops up periodically from Trump administration officials when they talk about North Korea, for example. It's not a crazy fear, because Americans, you know, when people rise up in the streets and they want to topple guys like Putin, America generally supports them. We like democratic revolutions, which isn't a bad thing. But, you know, because we're a democratic country, democracy we think is a good thing and it should be in more places. But from Putin's point of view, democracy isn't compatible with him staying in power forever. So the more we spread democracy, the more we push leaders out like Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, or we try with Bashar al-Assad and Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, the more nervous he gets, and he thinks we're coming for him. And to be honest, most people in, you know, in Washington and the national security and foreign policy establishments hate Vladimir Putin. And every time there's even a hiccup of an anti-Putin protest in Russia, everybody gets very excited, and they start, you know, oh, is this it? Is he going to be ousted? Is this, you know, is this the end? They're very, you know, and the opposition in Russia wants him to go for good reason. So he's not, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean nobody's after you.
Right.
Which is, I guess, the shorter way of saying that.
And what happened in the Ukraine in 2013 also, I guess, adds to this dynamic. I mean, it's right outside his door.
Right. Well, he also, I think, and a lot of Russians of his generation just don't believe that, they just don't believe that Ukraine is a separate country. They just can't get used to that idea, and they think that it's this kind of anachronistic joke. That said, Putin, because of his KGB background, you know, an FSB background, those guys tend to be extremely conspiratorially minded. They just, you know, nothing is as it seems. Everything has like seven false bottoms and has really elaborate, crazy explanations. And in their worldview, and I think in Putin's worldview, there's no such thing as an organic grassroots protest. That any protest like this is paid for by somebody to advance their geopolitical interests. And the fact that the U.S. got behind the protesters in Kiev because, you know, they were advocating anti-corruption and democracy and, you know, adopting more Western values, Putin saw that as, well, since it's in their interest, they must have sponsored these protests. They must have paid for them. These must be astroturf kind of protests, which they absolutely were not. But you have to understand that these guys just don't believe in anything organic and real. They just don't believe that that's possible.
Well, it's probably forged on their own experience in on the other side of those things. I mean, that's why he probably
absolutely
also thought the Panama Papers, I mean, that is... You don't grow up with an experience of a free press that goes and investigates things unless there is sort of some ulterior agenda funded by somebody. And so you, of course, assume that it's the sort of the classic projection there. And so, I mean, you set out to ask two questions. How did they do it? And what next? And we have a sense now of like what the state of mind and why Putin would have done this. But the how do they do it really just sort of feels like, you know, and you said it, they throw spaghetti against the wall and then they're just sort of like amazed, like, wow, it didn't just stick. It actually like permeated the wall and wound up on the other side.
And the wall fell down and now they're responsible for it. And there's a ton of blowback. They're really not happy with the way things turned out. They don't like Donald Trump. He's extremely unpredictable. You know, they were celebrating. There were people, kind of Kremlin loyalists, celebrating his inauguration in Moscow with live inauguration watch parties and champagne. I was in Moscow in April, so, you know, it was actually just about 2.5 months later. Trump authorized the firing of 59 Tomahawk missiles at a Syrian airbase after this chemical weapons attack. And Russians close to the Kremlin were saying to me, you know, Hillary Clinton may have been better for us. You know, she was at least predictable in a known quantity. We knew how to talk to her and what to expect from her. This guy is just nuts. So they're having, you know, and things totally did not go as planned. He not only did he not lift sanctions, his sanctions got basically iced in for the next, you know, generation by Congress because of what the Russians did. They lost even more diplomats and outposts here. Just things really did not, there's a lot of blowback. And I think my other, I guess the kind of third tacit thing that I was trying to get across in this article is Putin is not, and Russia is not, this all-powerful supervillain that we imagine it to be. And I think that if we want to understand what happened in 2016 and going forward, if we want to understand how to deal with the Russian threat, we have to describe the problem accurately. And so far, we're not doing that. We're really overestimating Putin's abilities and Russia's abilities. Russia is a fundamentally rotten, unstable country. Rotten, I mean, in the sense that, you know, the institutes of state are basically very rusted and rotted through. And it's, you know, it's just anybody who knows Russia is surprised by this, how we portray it in the U.S. as this kind of superpower that's capable of anything. It just isn't. And that doesn't mean it's not a threat, because they lash out and they do crazy, unpredictable things. But we have to understand it accurately in order to deal with it well.
I mean, I don't think I've ever come across something where I've been able to see both sides of it, where some people think there's a grand scheme behind something, but it usually just ends up being some measure of like incompetence and bad or good luck is usually the combination mm-hmm. of everything. And that's what it seems like here, that they... I mean, it sounds more like Putin and sort of the idea was like, we're just, well, all right, let's speak about it in terms of this. you address this in not I mean, it's rather quickly, but the idea that the fingerprints of the FSB and the GRU were left on these hacks, that there was no attempt to hide that they were doing it. And what accounts for that? And because it, I mean, on one hand, when you're describing a story, it's just like, we just want to let them know that we're messing with them. And, and this is the way we're going to do it, is that we don't want to hide it. We just want to say, like, yeah, we're messing with you, just so this is the tit for tat. This is like the, again, this is, you know, this is Tony Soprano just saying, like, you know, leave a calling card so they know that we take one of theirs, they take one of ours, type of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this is very much the MO of the Russian Secret Services. They do this all the time, for example, to Western diplomats and journalists who live in Moscow. You know, things like, you come home, and this happened to a friend of mine, the rug is gone and somebody has, you know, gone number two in your bathroom and not flushed, just to let you know that they can. And part of the point to not covering the fingerprints is to show you that they can, that they have these capabilities, that you're not as strong as you think they are, that you are, and we can mess with you. We can enter your inner sanctum.
Where does, I mean, and you don't address this in your piece, but where does Paul Manafort fit into this? I mean, because he, I mean, I don't know where he fits in terms of his relationship with Russia. I mean, how, was that just a coincidence? Was he part, I mean, how did he end up there and happen to also have these relationships?
I think Manafort is more of a a Ukrainian story. You know, there were a lot of foreign or a lot of American political consultants working in Ukraine to elect this party or that party. Both sides had American political consultants working for them. These American political consultants weren't always the cleanest guys on both sides. You know, their party's out of power, so they go to some other country to consult, make some money, keep the firm going while they wait for their people to, you know, run again or get back into power. He does seem to have some links to Deripaska, an aluminum magnate who is close to the Kremlin and is a very scary dude, frankly. But I think mostly Manafort is a story about corruption in Ukraine, which is pretty much as bad as it is in Russia, if not worse.
But I mean, so is that a total coincidence, or is it that, I mean, is he trying to get into somebody's good graces, and maybe he's aware that Russia has sort of is at least, you know, not necessarily looking for Donald Trump to win. They probably didn't think he could win. But that he would be part of that project of like, yeah, let's, I'm on team, Obama and Clinton in the eye, and maybe I'll get rewarded for this in some way.
I think that, Manafort was, you know, I don't know. I think we still have to wait for the facts to come out, but I think for Manafort, it was very much about money. And with him, it's going to be about following the money. We actually had a story at The Atlantic about these emails that he was exchanging with his former aide in Ukraine, where he was basically, you know, while he was working for free for the Trump campaign and was deeply in debt to Deripaska, this Russian aluminum magnate, he was sending emails to his former assistant in Ukraine saying, hey, does Deripaska see what a good job I'm doing on the campaign? Can you make sure he knows that I'm doing such a good job on the campaign? Which raises a lot of questions. You know, is he working off his debt to Deripaska by working on the Trump campaign? We don't know. But I think, you know, Mr. Mueller is going to have some interesting things to tell us.
All right. What is next? I mean, does Putin say like, hey, guys, we screwed up here and we went from, I wanted to send a message, but I didn't want you to kill him, type of thing.
It's like the kind of
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Like the Pine Woods episode?
The Pine Woods episode of The Sopranos.
Right.
Paulie and Christopher go to collect.
Right. And you're not supposed to bury him in the woods.
They're not supposed to kill him. They get into a fight with him, and then they have to kill him eventually.
So what does he say? So what do they do at this point? They say, like, we're done with this. Let's go hack into somebody else's. Let's just focus on Europe or what? What do they do? Or do they just keep going? Because why not?
So this is, and it's a very Russian thing where you just keep improvising and trying to get yourself out of whatever jam you have fallen ass backwards into, and which is what they did here. I think, so keep in mind, so go back to 2014. Russia just finishes up the Olympics. They look great. They win all the medals. It goes off basically without a hitch. They're in, you know, everybody's like, oh, wow, maybe they aren't a failing kind of third world country. Then Putin is like, oh, wait, things are getting crazy in Ukraine. I'm going to go invade. The West says, wow, you guys are crazy. We're slapping sanctions on you. We're kicking you out of the G8. We're suspending NATO, Russia, and military exercises. Basically, you're in the doghouse. Putin doesn't like being in the doghouse, so he keeps trying to get out of there by playing the counterterrorism card. And he says, okay, fine, you hate me for Ukraine, but look, we're all Western white Christian nations that the Muslims are attacking. We're on the same team. Let's fight terrorism together here. Look at me. I'm going to go to Syria and fight terrorism in a way that you guys are too scared to do. So he starts coming in from the cold on Syria. Then he goes and hacks the U.S. election and gets caught. Essentially, gets caught red-handed, and he's in the doghouse again. Now he's up for re-election in March, and the poll numbers for the government are starting to sag. The kind of Crimean popularity bump is basically gone. So what's he going to do to boost his ratings to come in from the cold of after what he did in 2016? Well, you saw him doing this big Middle Eastern tour earlier this week and visiting all these U.S. allies and trying to cut deals with them. What else is he going to do? I think it's always, you know, he's like that girl who's always dating the opposite of her ex-boyfriend, of her last ex-boyfriend. So
he's on the rebound,
kind of going from. But it's always important to do the opposite of the thing you did before. So he's, you know, he's kind of going from extreme to extreme. And I think that's what, you know, that's what makes him dangerous. It's not that he's a crazy mastermind who's capable of anything, who knows everything, who controls everything. That's not true. What makes him dangerous is that he's very emotional, makes very emotional kind of knee jerk last minute decisions, that are all kind of predicated on not being humiliated, on being respected. And this is why he does crazy things. It's not because he's like the perfect Bond villain.
I mean, he sounds like Kevin James in King of Queens. Like, the whole, everything can be explained by both the sitcom and The Sopranos, I guess. It's a fascinating piece. And I guess, so let me, lastly, I mean, do you think, we're hearing a lot from Capitol Hill that there is a real concern that the Russians are going to continue to meddle in elections going forward. Is there any reason to believe that they wouldn't do this? I mean, look, there's no reason to believe that we wouldn't do it and that we're not doing it. Is there any reason to believe that they're like, you know what, maybe we're going to back off this for like, let's give it a couple of years and see, maybe we don't want to get caught up in this again. Or do you think that they're going to continue?
I don't know. I think they might or they might not. They tend to, they tend to go as far as they can until there's pushback or until they meet resistance. So what I mean is they're not acting in a vacuum. They're informed by what's happening domestically in Russia and what, you know, how much we push back. And right now the American intelligence community, the, you know, counterintelligence forces that we have, the kind of cyber forces, aren't really doing much because this administration hasn't given them the go-ahead to fight back, really. So, you know, that's a big factor. You know, if we offer up resistance, they might not do as much. If we don't, I mean, it's natural, right? They're not crazy.
Julie Yaffe, the staff writer at The Atlantic, on the with the cover piece, What Putin Really Wants. Thank you so much for your time today. Really great. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, folks, we've got to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will... I like that. It's always fun to find out that the whole world is run by just like children. Really not just really destructive children. Right? I mean, how else would you describe that? I mean, when she's describing, like, he gets in trouble and then he goes and he cleans up his room. And
I'm totally not going to date those guys anymore.
But he's like
Putin as like ditzy, aggrieved college girl.
Hey, honestly, what she was saying, like, he screws framing up and then he tries to fix it. It honestly is like the elevator pitch for King of Queens or any of those dumb sitcoms with like the bumbling male lead. And, you know, he's got the wife who's always saying, like, Kevin, look what you did now. I'll make it up to you. And then he gets himself in trouble again.
I mean, to be fair, these are not skills that I necessarily value highly either, like empire competence, nuclear brinksmanship, that kind of thing.
Well, that's true.
It would be funny though to have a king of Queens where he poisons his wife with plutonium for being annoying, though.
Yes,
it's like, I'm totally going to date the opposite. I got to poison her, and then it's just the opposite.
I'm going to live with somebody whose dad is not in the basement.
I am Tsar of Queens.
New character alert.
Dad is not in the basement. She gets plutonium, and then I think I'm going to date a Chinese girl. You know what? Fine. I'm a little racist, but I want to do something different.
Fuck, folks, we're going to move into the fun half. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your support that makes this show possible. And I will say, our advertisers, I think we're going to see them all return in 2018. But audience dollars, obviously, and audience support, far better in the long run than advertiser support. If there was any doubt that anybody had about that, it was vanquished over the past couple of weeks. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You have less than 48 hours, assuming it is about 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern, on Wednesday when you hear this, to get 30% off justcoffee.coop. You can get the Majority Report blend. Even because Marc Maron was so nice in basically laying down the gauntlet last week, there's also the WTF blend, still a little bit more bitter and not as sophisticated as the Majority Report blend, is my understanding. But you can pick that up as well. 30% off, free shipping. Also, check out last night's The Michael Brooks Show. You had, who'd you have on, like in the first half?
Nathan Robinson, who is the founder of Current Affairs, and we deconstructed Ben Shapiro. We tried to take Ben Shapiro at face value and actually go over his arguments, which that's what Nathan's doing. He's doing a series. Charles Murray, Ben Shapiro.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, his argument is ultimately, of course, we can dismiss these people as sort of like corporate pawns and media creations. But part of their sales pitch, which is absolutely true, is that we don't have our arguments addressed by the left. We're just dismissed as bigots. And he said, okay, let's do that. So we went over his arguments. And then we dismissed him as a corporate pawn and a bigot. And then also many other things. But Mandela did respond to the Cernovich situation and what happened last week.
Nelson Mandela did.
Yes, yes.
Right-wing Nelson Mandela.
Yes, and he also had a message also about his appearances on this show as well.
Really?
Yes.
All right, well, I better check that out. So you can check that out on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever your podcasts are served, or you can go to YouTube and check it out on our YouTube page. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. We're going to head into the fun half. We still have a little bit of sound from the post and lead up to the Jones-Moore election. We also have an amazing story that Mike Cernovich may get in big trouble for.
Again, I don't. I keep not understanding this person you're referencing.
Mike Cernovich.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that guy. We've had dealings with him.
Folks, you all know that I'm not good at pronouncing names. Everybody knows that.
Usually you're more in the ballpark, though. Like, usually you're wrong, but I get what you're getting
at. I get it. I get him wrong. It doesn't matter whose name it is. So I want to apologize to Mike Cernovich.
There you go. Thank you.
MikeCernovich.com. MikeCernovich.com.
Well, you know, I mean, that's the thing. It's easy. There's no...
He does say it very fast.
He might not know it himself. He might not know it himself.
He's saying that he might not know himself?
Yeah.
I think it's
possible. Yeah, he might not know.
That is actually a very empathetic and very astute...
It's possible.
Urgent need of therapy comment. Yes.
You know, when you get involved in that type of tit for tat with somebody, you get to know them a little more. You get a little more sentimental about things.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So,
well, I was saying last night on the show that when I see him like huffing those pills in those videos, I actually have like a dude, like, be careful.
Yeah. Like, it's really, I worry about his dry mouth. I wonder why do you think he has such, well, look, let's do this in the fun half. We're not going to subject people to my concerns about someone, who a lot of people find absolutely abhorrent.
One of our freelance publicists.
Right. Exactly. I mean,
say what you will, I think his PR is tremendous for the show.
No, he does a great job. He does a great job. I just wish that he would focus a little bit more on his own image, because people get the wrong impression when you start passing fraudulent papers around, and when you start like hyping fake controversies that cause people to shoot up a pizza place. That's going to reflect poorly on you. And that's where I'm just concerned that sometimes it's some people, they give and give and give, and they forget to take some time for themselves.
That's right.
Anyway, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. I know you're watching, Mike, and I appreciate it. We'll also take your IMs. We'll be right back after this. We go to the fun half.